On behalf of the Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship and Religious Education at Brigham Young University and the Harold B. Lee Library, I'd like to welcome you to the first of 14 lectures celebrating Professor Hugh W. Nibley and his work on the occasion of his 100th birthday come March. I'm Paul Hoskison of the Neil A. Maxwell Institute, and I would like to acknowledge the presence here tonight of the director of the Neil A. Maxwell Institute, Gerald Bradford. Do you want to wave your hand, Gerald? Or thank you. And Wilfred Griggs, my friend and colleague of religious education, who's been instrumental in putting this program together. Wilfred. And I don't know if Michael Hunter is here or not. Michael Hunter from the Harold B. Lee Library was also very helpful in putting this program together. Are there any relatives of Hugh Nibley here tonight? Any cousins, children, hangers-on? Okay. Is there one?
Distantly related.
That's good enough. Thank you. In addition to celebrating Brother Nibley's 100th birthday with this lecture series, we're also celebrating in anticipation of the completion of the publication of the collected works of Hugh Nibley. It's been long in the making. About the time of the last of these lectures in March, volume 19 of the series will become available, namely the long-awaited One Eternal Round. On the table outside of the main doors out there, we have a little bit of information about the Neil A. Maxwell Institute. You're welcome to take some of the material as you go out or as you come in. Also, there are a limited number of flyers out there. I would hope that we could give all of them away, and if need be, we'll make more with the rest of the program for this semester, the next 13 lectures also. This will be a real treat, and it'll be a special treat tonight. I want to say a little bit about Brother Nibley just a little bit about his life, for those who may not know all that much. For a lot of us, this is old hat. Brother Nibley was born in March 27th, 1910. He was a gifted writer, a prolific author, a first-class scholar, and above all, a committed member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He was educated at UCLA, where he received his A.B., summa cum laude, and went on to Berkeley to receive his Ph.D. in history. He volunteered during the World War II and was a sergeant. Some of you may have read the book by his son called Sergeant Nibley, An Unlikely Screaming Eagle, aptly named title. After the war, by the way, he did teach at Claremont before the war, but after the war he came back to Brigham Young University, where he taught for over half a century. His classes were infamous for one-question essay finals, upon which the students' grade depended. Hugh was a fair grader who wanted to see his students thinking for themselves, but he did not believe in grade inflation. Many students were surprised to find out the real quality of what they had been producing. Brother Nibley insisted on reading the relevant primary and secondary sources in his research, and could read fairly fluently at sight Arabic, Coptic, Dutch, Egyptian, French, German, Greek, Hebrew, Italian, Latin, Old Norse, and surprisingly, Russian. As a writer, Brother Nibley was blessed with an ability to turn a phrase and compose on tight deadlines. At the end of the 1960s, he was publishing an average of 1.5 long, thoroughly researched scholarly articles a month. I quote from him about scholarly production and work. "What is worth saving will probably be saved, but that can't be very much, and in this world it's vain to pin one's hopes on the survival of anything for long. What belongs to the eternities will not be lost. The rest doesn't interest me very much." Through all of it, he was absolutely committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ and lived it with great consistency. I remember him saying once that he's always been furiously active in the church and never got anywhere. His son-in-law wrote, "I have been astonished by his complete lack of materialism, but equally astonished by his generosity. I have witnessed his deep faith in the Lord. While he certainly isn't perfect, Hugh Nibley is one of the most consistent people I have ever met." And we are celebrating his scholarship and his work with this lecture series. Let me introduce our speaker for tonight, Richard Bushman. For most of us, he doesn't need an introduction, but for those who don't know him, he grew up in Portland, Oregon, went off to the evil East and received his BA in American History from Harvard, continued there and got a PhD in History of American Civilization from Harvard, came to BYU and taught here and became one of the first associate directors of the honors program here at BYU. He left BYU and went to Boston University. Eventually, his fame and glory spread, and he was called as department chair to the University of Delaware. After that, he was given a nice chair. I forget the name of it. It's a long, hard-to-pronounce name, professorship at Columbia University, where he has spent the rest of his career. I just want to mention something a little bit personal about him, too. When I first moved to Boston, L. Tom Perry was the stake president, and Richard Bushman was his counselor. And when Elder Perry was called as a general authority, Richard Bushman took his place as stake president in Boston. Shortly after moving to Manhattan to teach at Columbia University, he was called as the Manhattan stake patriarch, from which he is now somewhat retired because he doesn't live in Manhattan very much anymore. We're delighted to welcome Richard Bushman back to BYU on one of his many trips here, and we are certainly blessed by being able to hear from him tonight. Brother Bushman.
Well, thank you very much for coming. And joining with me and the Maxwell Institute staff in celebrating the life of this incredibly stellar figure who set a pattern that it would take 100 people to live up to match and come anywhere near matching a scholarship. I'm personally very honored to inaugurate the Maxwell Institute lecture series on Hugh Nibley, who is surely the godfather, the spiritual godfather, along with Neil Maxwell himself, of this organization. Nibley's mind was capacious enough to encompass nearly all of the Institute's multifarious projects conducted these days. He may have been the first to grasp the scope of scholarship required to comprehend the Restoration. Before Nibley, our scholars, for the most part, concentrated on Mormon sources to support their work, with some reference to other texts. After Nibley, that was no longer possible. He brought virtually the entire ancient world into our purview, and those who succeed him must now do the same. As well as anyone, Nibley appreciated the achievement of Joseph Smith. And yet, as I will argue tonight, he approached the prophet from a strangely oblique angle. Like so many rising scholars of my generation, I had a Nibley moment. I had only the slightest personal acquaintance with him, and yet he came into my life at a critical time when my testimony was teetering in the balance. I had entered the mission field without conviction after my sophomore year in college, quite unsteady about my belief. When I told my mission president, J. Howard Maughan, that I lacked a testimony, he handed me a book and said, "See if you can find a better explanation than the one in the book itself." And so I began my first serious encounter with the Book of Mormon. I don't know exactly when Lehi in the desert and the world of the Jaredites entered the picture. It was sometime during the first year of my mission. I do remember that by my second year, I had written John Sorensen about about some problem of evidence that concerned me and received a generous 3- or 4-page epistle in reply. John was my introduction to the Mormon intellectual establishment, where at that time, Nibley, though still young, reigned supreme. I remember my fascination with the idea of Arabic poetry in the naming of hills and valleys for Laman and Lemuel, and the peculiar oasis on the southern coast of the Arabian Peninsula that Nephi named Bountiful and that Nibley identified as a pocket of greenery unknown to anyone in the West in Joseph Smith's time. These little specks of evidence was the kind of rational support I was looking for in my quest for conviction. Nibley opened up a Middle Eastern antiquity that I had not dreamed existed and securely located First Nephi in its desert culture. The passage I remember most vividly was the famous Snite paragraphs near the end of Lehi in the Desert. Here is Nibley at his sardonic and witty best. A young man once long ago claimed he had found a large diamond in his field as he was plowing. He put the stone on display to the public free of charge, and everyone took sides. A psychologist showed by citing some famous case studies that the young man was suffering from a well-known form of delusion. An historian showed that other men have also claimed to have found diamonds in fields and been deceived. A geologist proved that there were no diamonds in the area, but only quartz. The young man had been fooled by a quartz. When asked to inspect the stone itself, the geologist declined with a weary, tolerant smile and a kindly shake of his head. An English professor showed that the young man, in describing his stone, used the very same language that others had used in describing uncut diamonds. He was, therefore, simply speaking the common language of the time. A sociologist showed that only 3 out of 177 florist assistants in 4 major cities believed the stone was genuine. A clergyman wrote a book to show that it was not the young man, but someone else who had found the stone. Finally, an indigent jeweler named Snite pointed out that since the stone was still available for examination, the answer to the question of whether it was a diamond or not had absolutely nothing to do with who found it, or whether the founder was honest or sane, or who believed him, or whether he would know a diamond from a brick, or whether diamonds had ever been found in fields, or whether people had ever been fooled by quartz or glass, but was to be answered simply and solely by putting the stone to certain well-known tests for diamonds. Experts on diamonds were called in. Some of them declared it genuine. The others made nervous jokes about it and declared they could not very well jeopardize their dignity and reputations by appearing to take the thing too seriously. To hide the bad impression thus made, someone came out with a theory that the stone was really a synthetic diamond. Very skillfully made, but a fake, just the same. The objection to this is that the production of a good synthetic diamond 120 years ago would have been an even more remarkable feat than the finding of a real one. The passage reminds us of the watch in the field of deist fame, except that the argument takes a different form. The perfect mechanism of the watch points to something beyond itself. We want to know where it came from. Who could have contrived that intricate timepiece? There had to be a watchmaker, the logic requires us to conclude. Not so with the diamond discovered by the plowboy. Nibley structures the situation so that the diamond does not point beyond itself. His parable does not ask how did the diamond get there. His only query is whether the diamond is authentic. The plowboy, the stand-in for Joseph Smith, we must assume, did not need supernatural powers. He just turned up the gem in a furrow. We don't have to ask how he found the diamond. The only question Snite asks is how authentic is the diamond? In the story, the plowboy is an innocent bystander. We make the connection to divinity. Nibley does not have to fill in that logic for us. Once we know the diamond is real, we readily leap to Joseph Smith's inspiration, the existence of supernatural powers, and ultimately to faith in the church today. We do all of that work. The point I'm making is that Nibley leaves all of it to us. He says virtually nothing about the Book of Mormon as sign, as Terrell Givens has put it. He never uses the Book of Mormon as evidence of divinity working through a modern prophet. He's not interested in validating the plowboy who found the diamond, only in the diamond itself. I have focused on this one passage in Nibley's first apologetic work because I believe it foreshadows his treatment of Joseph Smith for the greater part of his life. In his early works especially, Nibley rarely mentions Joseph Smith. Nibley makes a remarkable statement in the paragraph preceding the Snipe passage. We have never been much interested in proving the Book of Mormon. For us, its divine providence has always been an article of faith, and its historical aspects by far the least important thing about it. What can he possibly mean when he says he has never been much interested in proving the Book of Mormon? How can a man who dedicated his life to that endeavor say he is not much interested? He has to have been interested to focus energy so zealously on that enterprise for decades, and then to say that the historical aspects were by far the least important thing about it compounds the amazement. What was he doing in all those books about the historical aspects if they were not important? His belief in the book, Nibley tells us, arises in another realm, the realm of faith, not from the historical aspects, which he considers the most trivial of considerations. Apparently, he did not need that kind of proof for either Joseph or the Book of Mormon. The book's divine providence, Nibley says, comes from another realm, his faith. And so we have an anomaly. Nibley battling ferociously to demonstrate the historical validity of the Book of Mormon, and yet apparently subordinating historical inquiry to a little mentioned realm of faith that hardly ever entered his public discourse. He seems to be fighting a ferocious rearguard action to protect the faith, which in the last analysis is what is most important to him. It occurred to me that my own experience in talking about Joseph Smith to Latter-day Saint audiences might bear on Nibley's reticence. Often in the question period, someone will ask me to bear my testimony. I'm a little put off by this question. I often respond that I've been bearing my testimony in every word I have said. The whole story of the prophet, as I relate it, is a testimony of the truth. But lying beyond the question, in my somewhat irritating response, is a significant cultural issue. The questioner has been hearing one kind of discourse all night, a scholarly, objective discourse, and is waiting for another kind of discourse, one more familiar, and one required when speaking of the prophet. She wants to hear, "I know," the language we use when speaking of Joseph Smith, a language of divine inspiration as opposed to cognitive examination. In asking the question, the audience is testing my loyalties. "All right, you have proven yourself to be a scholar," they implicitly say. "Now we want to know if you are one of us, the kind of us who knows about Joseph Smith spiritually. Will you deign to use our kind of speech and show yourself to be a brother as well as a scholar?" I bridle when asked, not because I wish to distance myself from the audience. "I am a brother," I would be quick to say. But testimony speech does not fit into scholarly speech. Bearing testimony at the end of one of those talks I sense in my gut would undermine the scholarly part of the talk, bringing into question my credibility as a scholar. Think of an attorney defending the church's interests in a court case involving the first presidency. The lawyer takes great pains to present the evidence and interpret the law to the end of persuading the bench and the jury. Near the end of his involved presentation, he pauses and says, "I also want you all to know that President Thomas S. Monson is a prophet of God by the power of the witness borne to me by the Holy Spirit. I know, therefore, that he is innocent of the charges brought against him." What is wrong with such a statement? It may very well represent the attorney's deepest convictions and commitments. Is it not proper to bear witness in all times and in all places? Yes, but we know it would be unsuitable. By shifting the form of discourse from evidence and legal reasoning to testimony and felt inspiration, the attorney weakens his own case. He becomes a special pleader rather than a trustworthy judge of the evidence and the law. Everything he has said before is thrown into question. I cannot imagine church attorneys changing their speech to testimony bearing, and I can't imagine their client expecting them to do so. I am suggesting that Hugh Nibley adopted a similar tactic when approaching Joseph Smith. He scrupulously remained in the mode of scholarly discourse, what could be proven out of the texts, rather than drawing out the religious consequences, such as the divinity of Joseph Smith's calling and the necessary evidence of his supernatural powers. I don't know that Nibley ever wavered from that discipline in his writings. Those who know him more intimately may think of instances, but in his published work, he was ever the scholar, asking his readers to grant him nothing more than an opportunity to lay out the evidence. He never implies any other method than scholarly inquiry was necessary to locate the truth. I think he always wrote with scholarly readers in mind. The fact that he argued in the court of scholarly opinion may have required him to stick with scholarly language so as not to undermine his case. He knew he would never persuade the scholars, though he may have hoped from time to time that Claus Baer or some other of his friends would yield a point or two, but he never wanted to show weakness. He would always meet the critics on their own ground and slug it out. He would not abandon his lawyerly posture to become a simple testimony bearer. He would assert no more than he could prove. And perhaps most offensively, he would never expose his faith to their attacks. The unbeliever's blows would never touch that vital spot beneath his armor. We must then content ourselves with Nibley's laser-like focus on the Book of Mormon and not expect him to take the next logical step and bear testimony of Joseph. There were doubtless many reasons why Nibley refused to use the Book of Mormon to reach conclusions about either Joseph's divine call or his character. In Since Cumorah, Nibley actually turns the reasoning around and objects to the practice of using Joseph to reach conclusions about the Book of Mormon. In characterizing the tactics of the critics, he says they reject the Book of Mormon because its author-translator was untrustworthy. The critics' version of Joseph undermined the book rather than the book supporting Joseph. Here's Nibley's words. "Opponents of the Book of Mormon have always depended heavily on vigorous declamations against the character of Joseph Smith. The accepted procedure has been to argue that since Smith was a rascal, the Book of Mormon must be a fraud." In other words, the critics spurned the Book of Mormon because it came from a disreputable source. Nibley objects to that tactic, less out of regard to Joseph's reputation, it would appear, than out of his desire to defend the Book of Mormon. He had, of course, recently defended the prophet in the book The Mythmakers, but he pointedly does not go into that argument here. The whole discussion of Joseph Smith's character, he says, has become academic, by which he means either moot or irrelevant. Is this as if he wanted to clear away all the underbrush created by the anti-Mormon accounts of the prophet as a man and make the Book of Mormon the issue, not Joseph Smith? Here's a quote from him again. "The whole discussion of the Book of Mormon has shifted ground completely, though critics of the Book of Mormon are still desperately determined to keep it on the old ground. Nibley was dedicated to moving the debate to new ground, that is, to discussion of the historicity of the book in its own terms, rather than of the prophet's character. He seems to imply that we should lay Joseph Smith, Moroni, in the 19th century story aside and concentrate, as Snyder recommended, on the diamond itself." We can understand Nibley's position better if we remember how badly treated Joseph Smith had been in non-Mormon accounts as Nibley was growing up. The best known work on the prophet had come from William Lynn, Iwood Bridge Riley, and George Bartholomew Arbaugh, who did nothing but deride Joseph Smith and his family. In 1903, Riley, who went on to become a distinguished historian of American philosophy, posed what he called the final question about Joseph Smith in his Yale dissertation on the founder of Mormonism. The question, was he demented or merely degenerate? An advocate of the epileptic theory of revelation, the idea that revelations were the side effect of a seizure, Riley left the final diagnosis of Smith's dementia to the psychologist, but concluded that his psychic coordination had disappeared and his genetic inheritance had degraded his mind and his character. Heredity had passed down those abnormal tendencies which mark the degenerate. As late as 1932, a University of Chicago Press book by Arbaugh posed a similar question. Was Joseph Smith only a fraud, or are we to regard him as a mixture of fraud, chance, and mental defectiveness? In these supposedly scholarly works, the Smiths were wounded, degraded people whose son lacked both intelligence and integrity. The degradation of the Smiths eliminated entirely any need to take Joseph's work seriously. As Nibley said in his review of No Man's History, the thumping biographies, as he called them, before Brodie's, had announced that Joseph Smith was a complete scamp. The Book of Mormon, therefore, as the work of a feeble-minded charlatan, could be dismissed without serious attention. Nibley wanted to change the intellectual agenda and make the Book of Mormon the issue, not the character of Joseph Smith. Although Nibley had attacked the detractors and the myth-makers, he apparently came to the conclusion the vindication of the prophet before authenticating his work was the wrong tactic. Let us leave Joseph Smith aside for the moment, he explicitly says, and look at what he produced, deal with the text that came from his hand. Dismissing the discussion of Joseph Smith's person as academic, Nibley chose to look at the indisputable fact that whatever his background and character, Joseph did give a big book to the world. You would think that his reply to Fawn Brodie's No Man Knows My History would compel him to present a favorable portrait of Joseph Smith to set over against Brodie's pious fraud. How could he treat a biography of the prophet without making some biographical judgments of his own? Surely there, glimpses of Nibley's Joseph would be found. Not so. Most of Nibley's response takes the form of attacks on Brodie's scholarship and reasoning, not a defense of Joseph Smith. Incidentally, it was a pleasure to reread that little pamphlet again, which has been so depreciated because of its sarcasm, but it was quite interesting to me to see how on the mark, Nibley was. Nibley recognized that compared to the previous biographers of Joseph Smith, Brodie gave the prophet relatively kind treatment. In his opinion, she did not write in anger. But although she went beyond the naked scorn of Riley and Lynn, her portrait was, in the end, no more satisfying. Here's Nibley. Brody's Joseph Smith is a more plausible character than the consummate fiend of the earlier school, in that his type is much more likely to be met with in the street on any Tuesday afternoon. But in the end, Brody's Joseph, in Nibley's estimation, was even less plausible than his predecessors. No blundering, dreaming, undisciplined, shallow, and opportunistic faker could have left behind what Joseph Smith did, both in men's hearts and on paper. What Brody failed to explain was what this dreamer produced, being, on Brody's account, a completely undisciplined imagination that spilled over like a spring freshet in a riot of intense color and luxury and detail, having a wild, unbridled fancy that was not to be canalized by discipline. Joseph should have produced a phantasmagoria of an incoherent mishmash, but did he? Here's Nibley. Again, instead of an opium dream, we find an exceedingly sober document that never flies off tangent, never loses the thread of the narrative, which is often quite complicated, is totally lacking in oriental color, in which the sermons are confined to special sections, in which, strangest of all, never runs into contradictions. Joseph might get away with his outrageous lying in little matters, but what outrageous liar can carry the game to half the length of Old Testament without giving himself away hundreds of times? Brody doesn't say. In the face of this extraordinary achievement, Joseph Smith as a person was, in Nibley's estimation, irrelevant. Here he is again. We know a butcher who looks just like the great Johann Sebastian Bach, and he walks and talks and eats and breathes the very things that Bach did. Only there's one slight difference. The butcher can't write music. Brody's Joseph is a real enough character. All the details are there, except one. He can't do the things Joseph Smith did. The only thing about Joseph Smith, incidentally, that really interests us. There, I think you have the heart of the matter. The only thing about Joseph Smith that really interests us, Nibley says, is the music. He could have walked and talked like any butcher without making a particle of difference. The personality is beside the point. Joseph produced a masterpiece, and nothing else about him need concern us. Why then say more about his character or even his divine call? In Nibley's mind, vindication of the Book of Mormon was an end in itself, apart from its implications for Joseph. In my opinion, Jack Welch has it right in the introduction to the Collected Works edition of Lehi in the Desert, where he says of Nibley, ultimately, the importance of the Book of Mormon, in his opinion, is that it conveys a remarkably clear and compelling picture of the plan of salvation. It exposes in unequivocal terms the foibles of the human condition and the choices all people face for temporal and spiritual survival. Nibley believed that the Book of Mormon was a diamond that could cut glass. It slashed through the falsities of modern materialism and humbled the mighty to the dust. The book and its message meant everything to him. The plowboy prophet, much as Nibley may have loved him, was subordinated to his precious find in the field. Tracking down references to Joseph Smith in the indexes of Nibley's collected works, I found the largest concentration in the reprint of a talk Nibley gave at a Sunstone symposium in 1989 on Criticizing the Brethren. It is the only place I know of where Joseph comes to center stage, and we finally get a view of Nibley's thoughts about the man. He called in Joseph on this occasion to address an issue that frequently troubles intellectuals: how to deal with criticism of church leaders. Nibley used Joseph Smith both as a model of an authority, the first among the brethren, but and also as a target of criticism. Nibley tries to show how Joseph operated in each of these roles, leader and target, as an example for modern church leaders and modern church members. The point he wanted to make was that Joseph was constantly under attack from lesser men who did not value him, but his reaction was not to get upset. He rolled with the punches. Joseph was open, free, and searching, and he allowed all men the same privilege. He was inclined to leave evil to the Lord rather than cracking down. I was interested to find that the Joseph Smith in this essay was an expanded version of the plowboy that Snite defended. Nibley portrays Joseph as the simple innocent, assaulted by scornful, arrogant, and ultimately unknowing critics. Joseph Smith did not lay claim to high intellect or worldly might, Nibley reminds us. He simply reported what happened to him. He spoke only of what he had seen with his eyes, heard with his ears, and felt with his hands. And yet he stumped them all. Nibley let Brigham Young drive home the point. The whole Christian doctrine, as Brigham Young put it, simmered down into a snuffbox. But when I found Mormonism, I found that it was higher than I could reach, deeper than I was capable of comprehending, and calculated to expand the mind from truth to truth, from light to light, to become associated with gods and angels. All this from Joseph. Nibley loved for the simple and plain to outfox the clever and wise. He spent his life showing how the plowboy surpassed them all. He loved it, too, that the simple prophet was neither pompous or self-aggrandizing about his powers. As he said, this is a man who was not going to get a big head. The epitome of humility and plain living himself, Nibley celebrated Joseph's open-handedness in granting his followers powers like his own. The prophet's advantage over the world lay, of course, in revelation, Nibley noted, but in the church every follower has an equal right to revelation. Search the scriptures, he quotes Joseph as saying, and ask your heavenly Father in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, to manifest the truth unto you. You will then know for yourselves and not for another. You will then not then be dependent on man for the knowledge of God, nor will there be any room for speculation. Reading along in Nibley's talk, I realized that he was offering more than a comment on criticism of the brethren. He was delineating the form of ideal social relationships within the church, what kind of people we should be, and how we should regard one another. He wanted a church of independent revelators who find the answers for themselves and who tolerate one another's mistakes when we stumble. He refers to the famous Brother Brown incident, where an old man was brought to trial for teaching erratic doctrine, and Joseph protected him. I never thought it was right, Joseph said, to call up a man and try him because he erred in doctrine. It looks too much like Methodism and not like Latter-day Saintism. Nibley's gloss on the story was that Joseph said that Brother Brown's teachings were absolutely ridiculous. He could not keep from laughing at his ideas, but Brother Brown had a right to them. We get another taste of Nibley's good society when he takes up the obvious question about what to do when evil appears. Can we just stand by? What would Joseph Smith do about evil, Nibley asks. Apparently not much. He didn't worry because God was in charge. Then, quoting Joseph again, notwithstanding we are rolled in the mire of the flood for the time being, the next surge peradventure, as time rolls on, may bring us to the fountain as clear as crystal and as pure as snow. Thus, Nibley concludes, with that perfect confidence, he never panicked, he never worried. This is a Joseph who was very sure of himself, again the simple innocent, resting in the assurance of his revelations. Not that Nibley's Joseph was never impatient. Nibley himself lost patience with more plodding souls, especially if they seemed puffed up with their learning. Joseph had it even worse. Here's Nibley. What a trial it must have been for one who had conversed with angels and with the prophets of old to find himself surrounded by a bunch of yahoos who consider themselves very important. And yet Joseph bore with his brethren, and Nibley advises us to do the same. We must tolerate one another in our failings. At this point, a little confusion enters the essay. I could not tell if he was counseling the critics to be patient with the brethren or for the brethren to be patient with the critics. Were church members to tolerate the brethren or were they to tolerate us? Finally, I realized he was advising generosity for both parties. If I esteem, he's quoting Joseph here, if I esteem mankind to be in error, shall I bear them down? No, I will lift them up, and in their own way too. If I cannot persuade them, my way is better, and I will not seek to compel any man to believe as I do, only by the force of reasoning. Do not watch for iniquity in each other. If you do, you will not get an endowment. This is Joseph. For God will not bestow it on such. Nibley concludes, this was a peculiarity of Joseph Smith, to love and esteem people deeply, but at the same time be perfectly aware of all their terrible faults. Of course, it would not be a good society for Nibley without scholarship. Although it had little to do with this topic, he could not resist a side comment about Joseph and learning. Joseph was an impassioned scholar. He hungered for learning. He reveled in it when he had a chance. He never tired of showing and explaining the papyri to his visitors. His own curiosity was typically the most lively of all. Joseph threw himself with passion into the study of ancient Hebrew writings, Nibley says of the prophet, and he made great progress through the year 1835, especially in Hebrew. It would be easy to underestimate his progress. By the end of the year, I'm sure, he certainly would have qualified for graduate study in Hebrew. Think of that. Joseph Smith is a graduate student in a PhD program somewhere. He knew much more about it than we give him credit for. Then a startling speculation from Nibley. Joseph, had he lived, might have been a specialist. He might have become a Hebrew scholar. For proof, Nibley quotes Joseph saying, my soul delights in reading the word of the Lord in the original, and I am determined to pursue the study of languages until I shall become master of them if I am permitted to live long enough. Just as well that never happened, Nibley happily concluded. Had Joseph and the brethren followed the line of study that fascinated him, we would be up to our ears today in hair-splitting discussions and recondite speculations. A church full of scholars, what a horrible thought. Adept at learning like few others, Nibley was scornful of scholarly pomposity. He reminded us that Joseph Smith had good advice for scholars. On the occasion of a dispute in the School of the Prophets, he wrote, I discovered in this debate too much zeal for mastery, too much of that enthusiasm that characterizes a lawyer at the bar who is determined to defend his cause, right or wrong. I advised them that they might improve their minds and cultivate their powers of intellect in a proper manner. Nibley brings Joseph's judgment right home. The critics, he says to his audience at Sunstone, are surely just showing off, which is what we do in sessions like this. Nibley has Joseph dealing with his followers' foibles as Nibley himself did. Joseph Smith retained his sanity by dealing with this type of situation in high good humor. I'm sure Nibley was thrilled to read Joseph saying, beware of self-righteousness and be limited in the estimate of your own virtues. You must enlarge your souls toward each other. We must bear with each other's feelings as an indulgent parent bears with the foibles of his children. You see, Nibley concludes, we're at school. We must be allowed to make mistakes. Overriding all else, Nibley sums up, is that grand feeling of love which makes life a joy, and everything I read about Joseph Smith reflects that promise. Joseph told the church, let me be resurrected with the saints, whether to heaven or hell. Then the classic, friendship is the grand fundamental principle of Mormonism, to revolutionize and civilize the world, to pour forth love. I do not dwell upon your faults, you shall not dwell upon mine. Presbyterians have any truth, embrace that. Methodists and Baptists, etc., get all the good in the world, come out a pure Mormon. At the very end of the essay, Nibley described his own relationship with the brethren. in a story about Spencer W. Kimball. Nibley traveled with Elder Kimball to a state conference in Arizona one weekend as an emissary of BYU. During a train stop in Los Angeles, Nibley characteristically hopped off the train to visit a bookshop near the station and purchased what he described as a 10-volume set of a very rare collection of Alphonsus de Ligorio, the 17th-century redemptorist writer on probabilism. Fascinating material. Rushing back to catch the train, lugging his 10 volumes, Nibley had to cross an empty lot. When he settled into his seat, Elder Kimball noticed that Nibley's shoes and trousers were covered with dust. What happened next left an impression on the scholar. Brother Kimball casually took an immaculate linen handkerchief from the breast pocket of his jacket and, stooping over, vigorously dusted off my shoes and trousers. It was the most natural thing in the world, and we both took it completely for granted. After all, my shoes were dusty in the race for the train, and Brother Kimball had always told missionaries to keep themselves clean and proper. It was no great thing, pas d'histoire. Neither of us had said a thing about it, but ever since, that has conditioned my attitude toward the brethren. Nibley told no comparable stories of Joseph dusting shoes, but one senses that in the prophet's tolerance of the wayward, the same kindness he discovered in Elder Kimball. Nibley's own richly furnished mind yield to the superior worth of such saintly men. Thank you.